Today in Studio 360, the movie star Angelina Jolie. Maybe you haven't heard that she's turned herself from a mere actor into an auteur, a filmmaker. If so, you're not the only one.
I was with my kids. They came to set, and they said, "Why does it say director on your door?" And I thought, I couldn't even have an answer. I just thought,
She's written as well as directed a new film called In the Land of Blood and Honey. And later, The Secrets of Pop Music. Figuring out exactly what makes certain songs into hits, from Elvis to Britney Spears.
They come up with these technological inspirations that are messing things up and hearing the beauty in the mess. That's an essential part of rock and roll.
And I'll announce the winner of our 420-character short story contest. This is Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, I'll talk to Angelina Jolie about the new movie that she wrote and directed, In the Land of Blood and Honey. And we'll announce the winner of our listener short story challenge, Fiction in 420 Characters. But first, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, it was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness, it was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. That, of course, is the great beginning to Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities. And to me, it seems especially true right now. As the new year gets underway, it's the age of radical flux and the age of paralysis, a time of yearning for authenticity and a time when 5 or 10 million people watch the Kardashians on TV every week. So where do we go from here? What's in store for our culture in 2012? Joining me to predict the shape of things to come are Paul Rudnick and Mary Elizabeth Williams. Paul is a playwright and screenwriter. Mary Elizabeth Williams is a cultural critic for Salon.com. Paul, Mary Elizabeth, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
So at the risk of outing you both as reality TV addicts, what version of America are we going to see reflected on television in 2012?
Well, I'm not a reality TV addict. It's just an occupational hazard for
sure.
Me.
Research.
I have to watch Toddlers and Tiaras. I have to watch Hoarders. It's part of it's
now,
part
Toddlers
of my
and Tiaras. Yes, that's great. Now, what is going to be the next thing, though? Because it seems to me Hoarders and Pawn Wars and Storage Wars and all those are the result of what we did a few years ago, which is buying too much crap, kind of crazily. Well, so what are we doing? What have we been doing that will now appear as a new generation of reality programs?
Well, maybe I'm just optimistic, but I would like to believe that the activism that we've seen really swelling in the last few years will lend itself to somehow being cheapened in the reality genre.
So Tea Party, Occupy, SmackDown?
I can totally see a Tea Party, Occupy, SmackDown kind of a reality show. Absolutely. I can see, you know, you see like the Morgan Spurlocks and the Michael Moores have already dipped their toes into television. And I think there's going to be more of that. I think we're going to see activism on TLC, extreme activism, Hoarders,
really?
Teen Moms.
I can imagine that.
Well, Kim Kardashian has announced a New Year's resolution in which she said that this year she wants to be more simple. And I thought, mission accomplished. I know. Check.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to something called Shipping Wars, which is kind of the next stage after Storage Wars and Pawn Stars, because it's about shipping particularly.
You're making this up or is
no,
this
no,
real?
No, 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 this is real. In which different shipping companies, often very independent contractors, bid to ship particularly ungainly objects like Vegas lobby sculptures or camels, and how to wrap them and how to get them on the flatbed. Plus the real hands-on hunting and killing shows, the ones where people grab catfish with their hands from holes in the riverbed. I think that seems much more, you know, authentic.
So what about music? I mean, auto-tune has been the rule of the day in pop music for the last decade or so. It can make us all sound reasonably good. Will it be more just more and more auto-tune and fakery, or will it be, you know, the totally authentic, not skinny Adele kind of?
Well, Kesha has an album coming out this year, so clearly auto-tune is not going to die anytime
soon. I'm glad you pronounced that name, because I've never pronounced it not knowing exactly how to do so. So now I know.
You're welcome.
When I first heard that, I always thought she sounded Yiddish. You know, she sounded like something, a curse my grandmother
Kesha
would use.
And the Klezmites.
Exactly.
I think, well, you know, Mumford & Sons have an album coming out this year, and the Black Keys have a brand new album that just came out last month. I think, you know, the first half of 2011 to me was so much about just how bad can it all get entertainment-wise. And then in the second half of the year, with people like Adele really breaking through, you know, you started to see, I think some of us as consumers of music and television and movies were saying, okay, I need something that sounds a little real. I need something that is authentic. You know, it's the uncanny valley aspect, right? That when things get a little too fake, that when things get real and fake, that we start to get creeped out. And now we've had this era where it's all been very fake and plastic sounding. And I think the natural trend, the natural inclination is going to be for something that's very different. What we love most musically, artistically, is always what's different.
Is there a new cultural artifact that's going to appear this year that will be the spectacular disappointment in a way that, for instance, the Spider-Man musical was?
Although Spider-Man musical just broke all kinds of box office records.
It's oddly rebounded and will be eligible for Tony nominations.
But it won't actually win Tonys, will it?
But I think it might get nominations because it's such a sparse field this year. So many musicals have bombed along the way and closed so early that Spider-Man, it's a genuine possibility. Plus, I think the theatrical community can sometimes reward success because it does keep people employed.
I think that in terms of what's going to bomb out this year, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's the film critic for Salon yesterday, Andrew O'Hare, and he was saying that he really gets this sense that these superhero movies have kind of played out and that the Joss Whedon Avengers really won't be as big a hit. It'll be the Tron
really,
of this year.
It has big want-to-see among my children.
But. Yeah. But it's you know, you look at Captain America and you look at Tron, and it does take a lot. I mean, the new Spider-Man movie will probably do well. But these kind of very formulaic, you know, full of action heroes movies aren't money in the bank anymore because they don't really appeal to the fanboys in the way that they once did.
And 3D, have we seen the peak of the excitement over 3D?
Well, if I had been sitting here 2 years ago and said to you, you know, 3D is going to be so not going away that there will be a 3D version of The Great Gatsby, I think you both would have laughed at
me. And that's true?
And yes, 3D version of The Great Gatsby, Baz Luhrmann.
I've always wanted Nick Carraway to be
coming
3D.
At me.
Exactly.
Coming out, leaping off the screen. The car accident's going to be pretty amazing.
And what? That's true. What about Facebook? I've been waiting for Facebook to peak and be over. It is having its big IPO and going public shortly. Is it doing it just in the nick of time?
Social networking in general is never going to go away now. It's too important. It's too much a part of the conversation. But I think we have reached a point of kind of saturation with a lot of our distractions. And we need some of our free time back. We need some of our lives back. And some of that's going to have to take place offline.
Paul, you are old school, right? You are not a big social media user.
No, I'm a very crude social media user, although I read it, and there was a piece by Lynn Hirschberg in W once where she said that Facebook allowed everyone to have their own reality show, which I thought was very true. And I think a lot of the new Tumblr, things like that allow you to share.
Everyone can be famous to 15 people.
Or at least share their lives on a more heavily produced level and a more heavily Photoshopped level. And I think that will continue because I think nowadays almost more than movie blockbusters or music people are always waiting for the next tech event. You know, I think that was part of the reason that outpouring of grief over Steve Jobs, that it was sort of as if Santa had died and who was going to make our next toy.
Maybe this 15 years of constant radical flux and newness in technology that has discombobulated the entertainment and media industries is slowing down and Maybe that's not such a bad thing.
But what's interesting is you know, you look at what the iPod app, you know, Apple's app of the year was Instagram. And this, you know, you see how we're clinging to...
Which is just a way of sending pictures.
It's a way of sending pictures, but it's a way of kind of making them look dirty and scratched up and old. And I find that really interesting. And, you know, you look at some of the biggest songs of last year, you know, they were songs with whistling on them. And I think, you know, and Justin Bieber did a steampunk video. There's this desire to, you know, taking the technology and just making it look old and making it look roughed up and very shabby. We're just shabby chicing
everything.
As Sam
Goldwyn said, once you can fake sincerity, you've got it made in Hollywood. Paul Rudnick, Mary Elizabeth Williams, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we also want to know what you think is going to happen during 2012. Tell us your cultural predictions for the new year at studio360.org. Just shoot for the stars. If it feels right, then aim for my heart. If you feel like it, take me away and make it okay. I swear I'll behave.
The first words I spoke in the original phonograph.
This is Thomas Edison recreating the famous moment when he discovered how to record sound.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
But did you know that there were audio recordings that predated Edison's phonograph by almost 20 years? Phonautograms, they were called, invented by a Frenchman named Edouard Léon Scott. But for the last century, nobody has been able to decode the information on Léon Scott's sheets and listen until a team of scientists and historians figured it out. One of these recordings has just been entered into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. We've got the firsthand story of the rediscovery of the phonautogram, told by a scientist.
My name is Carl Haber, and I'm a senior scientist in the physics division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory at the University of California.
An archivist of recorded sound.
My name is David Giovannoni. I'm an archaeophonist.
And an historian.
My name is Patrick Feaster. I'm an audio historian. I try to figure out what recorded sounds from the past mean, what they meant at the time, and what they mean for us.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when Edison recorded sound.
Edison came up with his phonograph in 1877, 17 years after Au Clair de la Lune was recorded.
What we're hearing is an experiment being done. Edward Leon Scott, the Martinville, is leaning close into the open end of a barrel, for lack of a better word. It was about a foot and a half long, at the end of which was a little vibrating diaphragm, like an eardrum. It's a membrane that vibrated as he yelled into the, or in this case, as he sung into the barrel, this little diaphragm would vibrate. Attached to that diaphragm was a hog's bristle. At the end of that, he had glued a tiny little piece of a feather. Okay, that's the sound gathering mechanism, all right?
Au clair de la lune, mon ami Pierrot.
Now you have the sound recording mechanism. Underneath that little vibrating bristle, he was turning a crank that rotated a drum. The drum is about as big as a large coffee can, and he's turning a crank that rotates that drum. The drum is wrapped in a piece of paper that's been held over a smoking lantern so that the smoke from that lantern collects on the paper and turns it black. Now, as he turns that barrel and it goes underneath his recording mechanism, underneath that feather duster, the feather duster vibrates and it leaves a little squiggly line on that piece of paper as it turns on the barrel. And it's that little squiggly line that's an analog, quite literally, of his voice.
So what we did is we got access to these squiggly line recording sheets that Scott created, and they were digitized so that they could then be read by a computer. and essentially calculate what kind of sound would have had to be present in order to push the little writing stylus to squiggle the way it appeared to.
When Scott was recording his phonautograms, he was cranking the cylinder by hand, so the sound was recorded at a very irregular speed on the drum. The reason that we can hear it today and have it sound like a tune we can recognize is that alongside the recording he made of the voice, he also recorded a tuning fork. Nice thing about a tuning fork is it always vibrates at the same rate. It's like time code.
Now, that's remarkable because, first of all, as far as we know, he didn't expect anybody would actually play this thing back. But he had the foresight to include this objective information about the speed at which the cylinder was being cranked as a record of information along with that is a very, very modern, enlightened, and very clearly thought out thing to do. And you just have to say, wow.
For every 5 vibrations of that tuning fork, I had to do a separate adjustment. Hundreds of these adjustments throughout the sound file. But bit by bit, over the course of that night, I got to hear Au Clair de la Lune slowly resolving itself out of that uninterpretable sound that we started with. And so about 5:30 that morning, I was able to sit back and think to myself, my God, I'm the first person living today who is able to hear someone singing before the outbreak of the American Civil War. That's the principle all modern sound media are based on. Telephones, sound recording and reproduction, microphones, loudspeakers, it all goes back to that idea that he could harness those vibrations of a thin eardrum-like membrane and use them to capture the world of sound.
For science, the people who made the first photographs, Edward Muybridge with the first motion capture, Leon Scott capturing sound, and then Edison and Bell and those who followed him. I mean, they essentially developed signal recording. And from a scientific point of view, this was really the beginning of modern scientific measurement.
You know, if Edward Leon were here today, what I would say to him is, dude, good work. just amazing, man. Although I try to say it in French.
What is the French for dude? We heard from David Giovannoni, Carl Haber, and Patrick Feaster telling the story of the 1860 phonautogram. It was just entered into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. Coming up, Angelina Jolie writes and directs her first movie. And she didn't make it easy on herself. For instance, the actors speak Serbo-Croatian.
This was never about making a film for me. It was always about learning about this area, working with other artists from former Yugoslavia. And I love the music, I love the art, I love the theater.
Angelina Jolie, she is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Don't go away.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You don't get much more famous than Angelina Jolie. Just bringing her into our studio today was an operation that involved a phalanx of security dudes, a tinted window SUV hurtling into an underground garage, paparazzi dodged. And her latest project isn't even about being a movie star. She has written and directed a movie set in the former Yugoslavia during the Civil War of the 1990s. It is violent, political, and in Serbo-Croatian.
Get your press, Mesna.
No.
It is one of the most complicated wars, one of the most complicated situations, which I did not realize how complicated when I started the film.
And really?
I didn't understand all the
layers. And the history, the insanely long history of it.
The history and all the sensitivities and all the sides and the confusing. It's very confusing because people, this idea that these neighbors suddenly turn on each other and these sides, what are these sides? When you meet the cast, they all look the same. And we'd say, so where are you from? What's your background? And 90% just said Yugoslavian.
Really?
Yeah. So even today, they don't want to be identified and separated.
At some point a few years ago, you decided as a non-screenwriter, as a movie star, as an actor, I'm going to write a screenplay. What made you decide to do that? And why this?
Well, I never intended to direct or make a movie. And
you weren't one of those people who said, yeah, someday, I want to direct. I really want to direct.
No, I was the opposite. I was I will never. And it still can't quite understand how it happened, except that I'd traveled for so many years around the world and visiting people in conflict and post-conflict and refugees. And
as a UN whatever you are.
As a UN Goodwill Ambassador or whatever I am. And in my personal life with my family in my children's countries. And so just witnessing all of that, I just had a lot of questions. And so I'd written journals and I'd written op-eds and I'd tried to come to terms with it. And I thought one day as an exercise, kind of as a writing exercise, here's my excuse to have to study this region. And therefore, I would get this, be inspired and push myself to get this great education on something that I feel I should know more about.
That's smart. And then when you finished it, you decided, oh, this is actually a screenplay. Let me see if somebody wants to make it.
I left it on my desk. It was Brad and I used to joke about it because he'd see me at
That's
night.
That's Brad Pitt, your husband.
Yes. And he'd see me at night when the kids would go to bed or sometimes, and he'd catch me scribbling on paper. And it was kind of this funny thing that I was doing. And it sat on my desk. And then one day he was taking a trip and I said, will you take it with you and tell me what you think? And he wrote me an email and he said, you know, honey, it's really not that bad. And you should show some people.
Yeah.
He was even nicer than that.
Yeah.
But he said, yeah, show some people. And then we decided that if this was actually to become a film, what we would have to do is send it to people from all sides of the conflict and send it without my name on it and see if it caused more tension, if it inflamed, if people were outraged or if they simply just were in any way uninterested in doing it or against it. So then suddenly the cast came together and they were all willing, and so then the family was born and there it was.
But you've never directed. You had never directed. Was that not a scary, daunting prospect? To do this war movie, this difficult piece in foreign location?
This was never about making a film for me. It was always about learning about this area, working with local people. I was so excited as an artist to work with other artists from former Yugoslavia and what could we learn from each other. And I love the music. I love the art. I love the theater from there. So for me, this was...
Yeah, me too. But
that's great. And then, so I... but yes, many days I had my my head in my hands and thought, oh... I can't. What am I doing? I'm not. The first time I was with my kids, they came to set and they said, why does it say director on your door? And I thought, I don't know.
That's
I
a good
even
moment.
Have an answer. I just thought, I don't know because I'm supposed to have some of the answers on this one and I'm trying not to mess it up.
So the film is a war story, but it's specifically a love story between a Serbian captain and his enslaved Muslim prisoner. Were you thinking of it as a kind of dark and twisted Romeo and Juliet?
Well, in fact, it's the opposite of Romeo and Juliet, because Romeo and Juliet kind of knew they were from opposite sides, and these two,
right.
Just like the actual people who played them, they were born in the same hospital.
Right.
One's Serb, one's Bosnian, from a mixed family.
And only one family is against it, even after it proceeds.
Yeah, and they, you know, this idea that one day they're told that they are different, but they know they're not and they weren't raised that way. And so then it's pounded into them that they're different through the course of the film and that they're enemies.
Which is a thing they then spend the rest of your film grappling with. Are we enemies?
Are we? And I think that's part of the question of the region is for people looking at each other in the casting. How did this happen to us? How did neighbors turn on each other? We're the same. So, you know, we have and everybody suffers in war, all sides.
Were you pulled in different directions retroactively saying, God, the Serbs were totally terrible and unjustified? And then would you move back and forth in terms of your you know, which team you felt most closely aligned with?
I just tried not to take sides. I tried to do the opposite. So I listened to everybody on the cast and I felt for them all, and I tried to show humanity on all sides. At the same time, of course, the percentage and the you know, the scales. You know, there's a reason why in the ICTY now there's 161 people, 60, one is gone, but you know, they're not all Serbs.
Yeah.
So
mostly,
but they are mostly Serbs, and I think that's what our film. I think that's how the balance of our film is. That there is all sides, but it is mostly.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, there was quite a lot of aggression and Srebrenica from one side.
I saw the film in Serbo-Croatian with English subtitles. I read that you decided at the last minute to film it both ways. Every take, every scene in English as well as Serbo-Croatian. When and why did you decide to release it in the United States, not in English?
I always wanted it to be in its authentic language. I always believe things are best done that way. But then you say, so I want to make a movie and I need millions of dollars to make a movie about a subject matter that everybody tells me is not one that's going to be easy to get people to go to. So then they say, you really need to do it in English. And so you struggle with that and say, I want people to see this, I want to discuss this, but that doesn't feel right. But then at the same time, we thought, well, everybody speaks English very well, and the few that didn't practiced. And we want to reach, even if some people are the type of people that don't go to subtitled films, we still want them to know about us, and they know about this, so let's make it for everybody.
There's quite a bit of graphic violence in the film, people shot, people blown up, women raped. Was there any moment in the production with your actors who, many of whom had lived through this history, where they pushed back and said, I don't want to be part of this. I can't do this.
No, it was the opposite. They braced themselves and they felt we have to do this because we want to show people, we need to show people what it felt like. And so they even knew, which I think was an extraordinary thing. It's often talked about that, you know, the women in the film show the violence against them, but the men that had to rape the women in the film, these are good men. These are the actual actors. Both of the actors who are rapists actually fought against the Serbs during the war and are both fathers and husbands now, and they're very good men. And the reason they played that is to show the violence against women. So for them, it was a very hard thing to do because it's not in their nature to behave that way as men. And they didn't like doing it to the actresses. They were very uncomfortable. But it was, in a way, a gift to the women. And the same, I think, for even the actors that came from Serbia to come out and they're screaming and yelling at the women, pulling their coats off. As soon as we'd call cut, they'd put their coats back on them, they'd apologize.
I mean, it's hard to imagine. I know a young Bosnian woman, and the depth of feeling hatred she still has for Serbians is intense, and she's spent most of her life in the United States. I mean, it must have been a lot of electricity on that set.
It was, but the actors that came together are all... all come from a moderate place and want unity and want a peaceful future for their children. So they are not those with extreme views. But of course, deep down, they all have a, you know, they know that the actor who played the lead actor, his father, he's a sixth generation Serb. He did not fight in the war, but his father was a Serbian general, and he did. But his answer to it was that he was going to participate and show this side and be in the film. So everybody was trying to, in some way, not heal the wounds, but discuss, move forward, and be a part of something.
Now that you have joined this very small group of women working as directors in Hollywood, do you think you'll keep directing more and acting less?
I would love to. I'm still...
Oh, really? So you've been converted?
I love being behind the camera. I did much prefer it. So.
Before I let you go, we asked our listeners if they have questions for you. And one listener wants to know a very specific question. Before the days of CGI, were you or directors ever concerned about the visibility of your tattoos?
Ah, that's interesting. You know, I actually did the opposite. I think there was a time... This is going to get far too psychological for no reason. But
yes.
There was a time when I think as an actor, you remain this blank canvas and you transform for the different characters and different characters. And you don't get tattoos because you must remain this clean palette, because what if your character doesn't have tattoos? And there was a part of me that felt that I wanted to claim my own body and this is mine. And so, the character's second to me. This is me. And so that was the first time. I remember thinking that when I got the first tattoo on my arm, that this would be a hard one. But I and my having a self, it was a strange, quiet moment with myself where I thought, okay, this is something that somehow maybe I can't cover, but can't cover everything.
And have you graduated beyond the tattoo getting part of your life?
No.
You're going to keep doing it?
So, well, most of my tattoos are, a lot of them were done in different countries or they're done tribally.
Oh, so they're
in
like,
Asia
like
for my
pins
children
and stickers that other people wear. So.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the coordinates when I met my kids, they're all symbolic of my family.
That's nice.
My mom, before she passed, always said it was like a totem pole of my history.
There
so.
You go. You seem like a totally sane person. Again, not that I expected a non-totally sane person, but you seem like you have a head on your shoulders.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
In the Land of Blood and Honey is in theaters now.
Pop quiz. What decade is this song from?
Do you believe in love after love? I can feel something inside me say, I really don't think you're strong enough now.
Has to be 1990s, 1998. That is Cher singing Believe. Auto-Tune, the pitch-correcting software, which sounded so new and wild in that song, has become pretty much ubiquitous ever since. Auto-Tune helps imperfect singers sound better, and it's been the defining effect in pop music for the last decade. Every decade of pop music tends to have its own sound, and that's often a function of technology as much as it is musical style. Studio 360's Jocelyn Gonzalez explains.
My CD collection is chock full of tracks that were cool for a hot minute.
What's catching your ear there is the production that made it novel and that might have sounded crazy at the time. And you say, like, hey, a lot of that has to do with the effects that were applied.
That's my partner, composer and producer Patrick Grant.
By effects, I don't mean new instruments like synthesizers. I mean signal processing. And some of these may have been passing fads, but a lot of them have gone on. Well, look at my rig here. For musicians like me, they've become solid parts of our toolkit.
Arguing over how certain effects were invented and who used them first is sort of an Olympic sport to gearheads. But this isn't about engineers. It's about music fans. So we're going on a special effects trip back in time. What? How could I not use that sound effect?
Well, bebop, Luna, she's my baby.
First stop, the 50s.
The sound that struck my ears, the sound of that decade, would be that slapback reverb I'd be hearing on Bebop-a-Lula.
Artificial reverb was invented in the late 1940s to recreate the sound reflections of a concert hall.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right.
slapback is the signature sound of producer Sam Phillips' legendary Sun Records. It's a type of delay created by using both the record head and the playhead of open-reel tape machines, or by feeding sound from one tape machine into a second. First, you'd hear your original audio signal, and then a playback of that signal immediately after the first. John Pareles, chief pop critic of the New York Times, says slapback wasn't just a novelty. It added something to the music.
It gives you an extra level of syncopation. It suddenly makes a straight walking jazz bass into something that's like bouncing around your head. It makes you a larger figure in the musical room that you're creating.
Thinking of where popular music was right before the smaller combos of rock and roll was the big band. You know, 18, 20 people on stage, and all of a sudden we're having like maybe four people. Maybe that was a way of keeping that sound.
It did change everything when you could have that much sound from one person instead of a whole unified section of horns or saxophones.
As pop groups graduated from clubs to concert venues full of screaming teens, the music had to find some way to fill the larger spaces. On records, Phil Spector built his wall of sound with huge slabs of reverb on big hits by the Ronettes. But there was another, grittier sound on the horizon.
What could be more 60s? What could be hairier and frizzier and more unkempt and more acid rock chaotic than distortion? I mean, of course that would emerge in the 60s. Well, distortion is when you turn your amplifier up to 11 or when, you know, you wreck the signal paths.
Yeah, you can get that dirty sound by overloading the signal. What you're also getting is you're getting every overtone of that note added to the original one at the same volume, and that is the classic electric guitar sound. For instance, I'll play a guitar riff cleanly with nothing on it. And now, notice the difference when we add the distortion, all the overtones to all these notes.
But that's the thing. I mean, when the mistake becomes the innovation, they come up with these technological inspirations that are messing things up and hearing the beauty in the mess. That's an essential part of rock and roll.
Okay, so here's the opening of Brain Damage by Pink Floyd. And it opens with a guitar picking pattern with a slow phase shift around it. There's all these extra colors, you know, thrown onto the pattern now, and I'd say that they're just as much part of the song as the notes being played themselves.
In the 70s, pop music relied more and more on studio electronics, and the whooshing sound of phase shifting and flanging came into play. You could find it in the progressive tunes of Queen and ELO, and the disco anthems of Studio 54.
Little kids can do this themselves just by slowly opening and closing their mouth cavity by going like, wow, and I'm singing the same note, but I'm getting more harmonics by opening and closing my mouth. And that's what these machines would do artificially.
Now, I can't help but thinking that the phase shifting coincided with the universality of the smoke machine on stage. I mean, your guitar arrives with a jet trail.
That's a good call.
Shall we move on to the hair decade?
they're all hair decades.
As we get into the 80s, more of the old tape delay effects became available as cheaper, portable gadgets. Tape echoes went digital and started multiplying, and that's where we got effects like chorusing.
It became most famously applied to the voice as a new way of, you know, thickening up, you know, thin pop voices. But when applied to instruments, like the guitar, for example, it became a whole new way of playing the instrument, most famously via The Edge from U2.
There's the scene where in It Might Get Loud, the documentary where The Edge is making this mighty sound with his guitar, and it's bouncing all around, and it's beautiful, and it's huge.
This is what I'm actually playing.
The instrument he's been playing is his effects panoply. The thing I look at 80s productions, it sounds kind of hollow to me now. Production effects are like haircuts. They looked really good at the time. 5 years later, you think, why did I do that?
And who wants to remember that old mullet you sported in the 80s? Not me. Next up, the 1990s.
Guitars were back, and how could we make them different than they sounded before?
Led by Nirvana, the popular bands of the grunge era amped up their wall of guitars with a new take on a common studio tool, compression.
Butch Vig, who did Nevermind, is a very slick, smart producer, but that compression is one of his trademarks.
Most songs have loud parts and soft parts and everything in between. They can compress or limit those peaks of volume and squash them down. They call it squashing it down, so they can lift the overall volume all the way up to 0 dB, which is the maximum in the digital world.
It's been said that a lot of records became popular in the 90s just because they were the loudest songs on the radio.
It makes each song jump out of the radio, but sometimes you don't want somebody to jump out at you. Sometimes you want somebody to embrace you or invite you in. And, you know, if it's all screaming at you all the time, you just can't listen to it. You get ear fatigue.
I'm not loving you way I wanted to. What I had to do, had to run from you.
For 50 years, we've been fattening up our pop tunes, making them bigger, fuzzier, and louder. But in the aughts, autotune, used in its extreme settings, seems to be doing the opposite.
I don't want to be down on autotune because it's not natural. Recording is not natural. Recording is an illusion. So that, to me, isn't the problem with autotune. The problem with autotune is that it shrinks human horizons, whereas some of the older effects that we're talking about expand them.
See, I wanna move, but can't escape from you.
You're hearing no glide in between the notes. You're hearing 12 discrete steps per octave, just like on a piano.
Right. I mean, there are people like Kanye West probably, you know, can't carry a tune in a bucket. It's nice that he can be auto-tuned if he wants to sing a melody. But when you have a real singer, why are you forcing them onto these 12 exact pitches when there are all these places in between where they can express something? We are fusing with our machines, so I think we found the effect that expresses that. What I hear is somebody coming through a machine who's coming through my headphones into my ears. So it's really an expression of our digital universe.
There's another effect I've been hearing more often called the stutter edit. It cuts up melodies and vocal lines into repetitive chunks, in a way making them sound even more pixelated. Is this the next big pop effect? I hope not. Right now, one of the biggest selling artists on the charts is a woman with a big voice and a broken heart. That's a special effect that never goes out of style. For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
I heard that you're settled down, that you found a girl and you're married now. Your dreams came true. Guess she gave you things I didn't give to you.
That, of course, is Adele. To see a playlist of all the songs from that piece, go to studio360.org. Coming up, we asked you for original fiction.
I pace my side of the lake we swam all summer. Winter's first blizzard has blocked all roads. The half-mile swim between us is now a walk across thin ice.
Teeny tiny stories by you. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360.
Last month, we gave you a challenge. I talked to the illustrator turned author Lou Beach about his collection of really, really short fiction, each story 420 characters long. And then I asked you to try the same. Hundreds of you sent in stories. Thanks. You can read them all at studio360.org. Now, Lou is back with me to judge our listener challenge, and he's also the creator of our prize, an original illustration signed. Hi, Lou.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
Good. So what struck you about these 400-odd entries that emerged? Were there themes?
Mortality seemed to play a large part in some of them, or dying relationships. It was quite a challenge to narrow it down to just a handful and then pick these two that I'll read for you.
Well, and just to go over the rules again, they had to be 420 characters or fewer, and we had to get the stories before the deadline, which was midnight on New Year's Eve. So first of all, let's hear about the runner-up. This was a story by Mary Sufi of Vacaville, California. And why don't you read it for us?
Okay. I pace my side of the lake we swam all summer. Winter's first blizzard has blocked all roads. The half-mile swim between us is now a walk across thin ice. I say I'll cross when the ice is thick. You propose we meet now, halfway. And then? If the ice cracks on your side, you'll jump to mine, you say. Where have you studied ice? Think how a window swallows a baseball. You really want to take a swing at that?
That's by Mary Sufi of Vacaville, California. I love that. It has backstory, it has love, it has drama, it has a cliffhanger.
Yeah, and that line, think how a window swallows a baseball, is beautiful.
That beautiful and surprising and really nicely done. Let's move on to the winner.
Okay.
And in fact, let's give her a call in Australia where she lives and tell her she won.
What time is it there?
I have no idea. Hi, is that Samantha Wilson?
Yep, that's me.
Hi, this is Kurt Anderson.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I want to let you know that you are the winner of our 420 character short story challenge.
Really? Excellent. Thank you.
You are. And there were about 420 entries. So
oh, wow.
It's a serious competition that you've triumphed in. I want to introduce you to Lou Beach, who is also here on the line with us.
Hi, Samantha. Cheers.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Lou.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This is a nice thing to wake up to.
Yeah. Good morning.
Thank you.
So you're in Melbourne. What work do you do when you're not writing 420 character stories?
I'm a proofreader right now for an advertising company, and I also run a theatre company that's just been at the Edinburgh Fringe.
So, Samantha, would you read your story for us?
Yes. It was dog number four that put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. It was about a month after the cafe went out of business. Less, maybe. He comes home with it in his arms. Big thing, but still in his arms, carrying it across the threshold. I think he was trying to be funny, but it wasn't funny. He was never funny.
Lovely work. Lou, tell me why you liked Samantha's story so much.
Well, you know, because of the constraints of the 420 character limit, there's a lot that has to be taken out. And this is an odd way of looking at it, I suppose, but she had more missing than some of the other favorites of mine. It was very conversational. It wasn't forced. It wasn't trying to be literary. It just told a story, and it made me laugh. And that might have been the final thing that did it.
Samantha, did you find it difficult to limit yourself to the very tight word limit?
No, I think I came under almost. I don't know, it's just somehow just made sense writing it. I've been reading maybe a bit too much Roman Carver lately.
Is there such a thing?
Sorry?
Is there such a thing as too much Roman Carver?
Oh, is there such a thing? No.
I also wondered, Lou, if you were a sucker for Samantha's story because there's a dog in it. So many of your stories have dogs as well.
And it had a coffin. How can you beat that?
There you go.
That dog in a coffin. That's all you need.
Well, Samantha, congratulations and good luck with your future writing, your future theater, your future proofreading, and everything else you do in Melbourne.
Thank you very much.
And Lou, thanks for inspiring this incredible turnout of creative effort on the part of our listeners.
Oh, I had fun. I hope your listeners had fun as well. Thank you, Samantha. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everybody who entered our contest. Your stories were a total pleasure to read. Lou Beach's book is called 420 Characters, and you can see the winning story by Samantha Wilson and hundreds more at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's program. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Our series on the National Recording Registry is produced by Ben Manila, Devin Strolovich, and Eric Beith. It received support from the Library of Congress. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, what's it like for David Byrne to watch 35-year-old Talking Heads videos?
This is a person who is profoundly uncomfortable addressing an audience and yet puts himself in that position. If I can refer to my earlier self in the third person, he had to.
David Byrne, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.